Nobody especially wants to talk about death, but it has to happen at some point because everybody dies. That knowledge alone provides no comfort, but there's a lot we can do in the final days of a person's life to provide love and comfort to the person dying and to his or her loved ones. Our guest this hour said goodbye to her husband several years ago, and she shares thoughts on how to make the closing days meaningful in a book of words and pictures called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. Suzanne Severide wrote the book. She lives in the Ashland area. She's a presenter in person and in many media. She's acted on TV, produced documentaries for radio and TV, chaired conventions, and taught public speaking and presentational skills. She sings, too. Suzanne is the author of a suspense novel published in both English and Dutch, and she contributes to the Daily Tidings newspaper in Ashland with her Mocha Musings column. Suzanne Severide, lots of talents. Welcome to the table.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Wow, you did your homework.
And you are a radio host on this very subject on KSKQ Community Radio. Tell us about that show.
Well, together with Julie Lockhart, executive director of Winter Spring, for, gosh, over a year, we had a radio show on KSKQ. And it was all about this subject. It was about various experiences people in the community have had with death, with losing loved ones, with how they coped, how they didn't cope, maybe what they could have benefited from. And it was really a very fascinating show to be part of. So she and I co-hosted it and co-produced it.
Did you make the connection with the Winter Spring Center for Grief and Loss out of your own, I assume out of your own experience?
I did. Actually, it was when I first moved to Ashland, one of the first people that I came into contact with here mentioned it. I had never heard of it. And I went home and called them right away. And what I loved was I got a live person on the phone. They were extremely compassionate and caring. I know that that person still works there. And I asked for some information, went to their website, and got in touch with them. And one of the real lifesavers for me, actually, was that I went to one of their support groups right away, a spouse loss support group. And it was interesting because it was one of the first moments I had after the death of my husband where I walked into a room of people and I didn't have to say a word. They just got it. They just knew it.
They knew why you were there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's the sort of thing, you walk into the lobby of this place and you see this sign with an arrow pointing this way and you're going to yourself, your inner voice is like, no, that sign's not meant for me. What am I doing here? I don't want to be here. You know, everything's kind of resisting. But when you're in that room with people who've shared a similar loss, there really is something so supportive and comforting and kind of magical that happens. And that 8 weeks was just the changes I saw in people and in myself just through that kind of sacred environment they're able to create because it's so safe. It's a very skilled environment that they create there as well, because the people who head up those support groups have been trained and know what they're doing. So, yeah.
So it's sort of like forming a new family. Have you maintained some friendships with the people in the group?
I've maintained a couple of connections with the group. And certainly, you know, at that time and then within that kind of year period, we were close. Now we've kind of moved on a little bit, which is also a very healthy thing to do, too.
I want to talk just about the grief itself, mm-hmm. without talking about the person you were grieving. Tony von Rinderham was your husband, mm-hmm. Who sounds like a person of many accomplishments himself.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Yeah. He was considerably older than I was. And even with the age difference, we had more than 30 years together. And I was very fortunate because we had a wonderful marriage. He cherished and adored me every day of our marriage. And, you know, now that I'm this much further away from the actual death, I can really appreciate that. And I can sit here with you, Jeffrey, and I can feel the warmth of that and smile about it. But it takes a long time to get to that point. It really does. But yeah, he was actually one of the, you know, fighters in the Dutch resistance at the time in Amsterdam.
In World War II.
And, correct, mm-hmm. yes, and condemned to death in absentia by the Nazis, and they never caught him, but he was underground. He worked actively underground every single day of the resistance.
Wow. So as you mentioned, considerably older than you.
Mm-hmm.
Had you and he had detailed conversations about his wishes for when the end approached?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I would strongly suggest that for anyone. He was a very pragmatic man, having been in the resistance, and he had been in the Dutch military prior to that. So he saw people die. He knew that people do die. And he knew the realities of life. And so he was very, very aware of his wishes. He made them very clear in writing, verbally, with physicians, with me, with hospice personnel. And not only did it facilitate the, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of a situation like that, which we also have to deal with, but it protected me as well. It did not leave those open-ended questions, which can be so devastating.
If I
painful.
Should do this or
yes,
yeah.
Yes. And I think even if people are very clear, it's still so extraordinarily difficult for people when they have to face those issues, because there are always question marks.
Suzanne Severide faced her husband's death 6.5 years ago. Her book about dealing with situations like that in your own life is called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. It's a relatively light book in terms of it's not a very fat book. Let's put it that way. But it's got some words. It's got some pictures to help people get through that part of life when somebody else's life is ending. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back. Let me let you know, too, that Suzanne will be signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, a reading and a book signing. And we'll come back to the discussion with her here and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We are discussing a subject people don't generally like to discuss but need to at some point, and that is the end of life. Suzanne Severide helped her husband off the planet 6.5 years ago and wanted to share the thoughts of things that helped her with people who followed in her footsteps. The book is called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. Illustrated as well with photographs by her son, Pablo Van Rentergem. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 over the phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned that that your husband, Tony, had detailed conversations set up. It sounds like advanced directives, living will, all that stuff.
Correct.
But in the latter days, though, I mean, just when he knew he was feeling poorly and wouldn't be around much longer, was he able to communicate the things that just made moments meaningful to him?
Yes. I feel very fortunate, because he was completely sharp as a tack until the day before he died. So we did not suffer emotionally and psychically, maybe the way some people do. I truly think Alzheimer's must be one of the toughest things for people to endure. He spoke 5 languages, and he was still able to pick up the phone and speak in fluent French or Dutch or whatever, English, of course, whatever, till literally the day before he died. So we were very fortunate, but he also made a choice. He did not want to take a lot of drugs that were going to affect his mind. And he said, if I can't be clear, I don't want to be here. So he made some very, very concrete choices. And it's important to have physicians and medical care around you that respect those choices. And I'm glad to see, I do believe we're moving more in that direction. I think palliative care is a tremendously important thing for us to be discussing and making more accessible for people. And I think it's important for the patient to have, say in how they spend their last days and months, sometimes years, because you can be in hospice care for quite some time.
Let us take a phone call. Steve in Eugene has an interesting question about the end of life. Steve, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Suzanne Severide.
Thank you. Oregon has a Death with Dignity Act. I wonder if such a thing was available in the state where he died. If not, do you think it would have helped or hindered his passing? And what are your thoughts overall on this subject?
All right, Death with Dignity. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. Assisted suicide by another name.
Yeah, thank you, Steve, for calling in. I'm a really strong supporter of Death with Dignity initiatives. I think anything we can do to bring comfort to people, both emotionally and physically, at the end of their lives. And, you know, we're dealing very often with people who are in just excruciating pain and who are looking at an end-of-life situation that is grim, beyond grim. So I'm a strong supporter in that. We were living in Washington, the state of Washington at the time, and as a matter of fact, it had just been passed, but it was very, very new, was still being tested. So that really didn't come into our picture at that moment. And, you know, everybody's circumstances are different. But to answer your question, I'm a real strong supporter in that. And I hope we'll continue moving forward to giving the patient, you know, more control over the end of their life decisions.
Now, in terms of dealing with the survivors of the person who's died, you talked about going to Winter Spring, mm-hmm. Center for Grief and Loss. How soon after Tony's death?
I would have loved to have gotten in touch with them much, much sooner than I was able to. We were living in a rural area, didn't have a lot of funding for things of that nature. And so the resources were extremely limited. There was really not a single bereavement resource that I could find for our son, who was 12 at the time. So when I moved to Ashland, which was over a year after Tony's death, that's when I was able to be put in touch with some of these resources. But I can tell you, the sooner you can start leaning on those resources, the better it is.
So when did you go from the point of taking things that were offered and available to you to sending it out the other way and passing the good feelings on, or the better feelings
yeah.
on, in a sense?
Well, it took me a long time. It really did. I really struggled with the grief, and I was in very deep pain because we had such a tight, long marriage for so long. We were co-creative partners, and the fact that our son was still quite young, it was difficult. However, having said that, I'm deeply grateful that our son was with me and that I had that, because that really kept me going a lot of the time. But, you know, a couple of years afterwards, I started just kind of writing down thoughts, and then I started playing with kind of putting together a little book idea. And talked with Pablo. He has been taking photographs for a very long time and has won awards for his photography. And so I started kind of getting some of his photos, and I created kind of a little dummy book. But it was, you know, it was a few years before I was able to move it to that point, definitely.
Suzanne Severide's book has taken shape, which is why she's here. We're talking about When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. It is her words and her son Pablo Van Rentergem's pictures. Okay, coalescing into a book. I mean, did anything help you like this when you were in those days? I mean, before Tony passed, if you had anything like this handy.
You know, that's one of the reasons that I put this together, because I really wished there had been a book like this for me. There were some handouts from hospice, which were helpful, but I put it together absolutely from the inside out in the hopes that this could be helpful to other people in the future. That's totally where this book sprang from. That's why I'm sitting here talking with you today. If it can help one other person out there, then I will be very, very happy. And, you know, I do wish there had been a resource like this for me. And that's the feedback I'm getting, which I'm so, I'm really gratified by, that I'm getting emails sent to me. It's my understanding that, the book is being distributed by the Asante Hospice staff now. An anonymous donor gave several books. And, you know, I'm just really thrilled that caregivers are emailing me, hospice volunteers, just people out there in the public. And they're saying, you know, this is just, I'm really finding this a valuable little book. So that's what makes me happy.
Well, I can place a characterization on it. I'd say that the general theme of the book would be to have meaningful moments, and I don't don't think in terms of what's coming, but think in terms of what you got at the moment and what you had in the past.
You're right. And I think probably one of the key lessons, and I don't mean to sound kind of trite, but it really is true, is to really, really stay in the present as much as you can, because it is possible to stretch those moments. It really, really is. And I had an example where I'd bought this sweet tablecloth somewhere with tulips on it. And after Tony died, I was organizing some things. I came across that and I thought, oh my gosh, I don't think I ever even used this. And I went back and I looked at some pages in my journal by happenstance, and I saw I had made some detailed notes of a moment where we had cleared off the table next to his hospital bed, and I had spread out the tablecloth, put a little single flower on there, and, you know, poured him a little drink, and I had a drink and lit a little candle. And I had even described that I used that tablecloth, and it gave me such comfort to know that, you know, I'd done that. So you're right, little moments that we can create, and they do bring such joy, not only to the person, but to you later on too.
It really is about clearing out a space to still be human. I mean,
yeah.
But literally in the sense of, like, I'm going to, you know, take this hospital table and I'm going to put a tablecloth on it and a vase and
that's right.
That kind of stuff.
That's right. To create the beauty and to create the love and the feelings that are there and that can just get somehow chopped apart by that medical process and by all the things that are happening. You know, this invasion of your life that any kind of illness can bring. And it is important to try to really stay close to what's important and the love and the connectedness that you have with that person. And that will help them tremendously. It will really help them as well.
You mentioned Tony's hospital bed. So did he die in a hospital?
No, we had it at home.
Mm-hmm.
We had it at home. And that was one of his wishes. And I'll tell you what, I was a dragon at the gates. I made sure that happened.
Really? Who did you have to be a dragon with?
Oh, there are times when the medical profession has a certain way of doing things. And again, we were fortunate that we had a doctor who respected Tony's wishes, and we had, you know, hospice volunteers. But even the doctor told me, she said, you know, I've had couples where they both were in agreement, but one panics and calls 911. And before you know it, that person's in the hospital, and then you're involved in a whole procedure to get them out, or they end up dying in the hospital when it wasn't their wish. So, you know, you just find that you have to really, really make sure that you stay extremely cognizant.
Suzanne Severide is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a presenter, is the easy way to talk about it. She's acted on TV, produced documentaries for radio and TV, chaired conventions. She sings, she acts. I don't know if she dances. We haven't established that yet, but she writes
only very badly.
Okay. But she's put together a small book to help people through watching a loved one die. It is called simply When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. It's her words and her son Pablo's pictures. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. If you have a story to share in particular, we would like to hear the things that helped you have meaningful times with a loved one on the way off the planet. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I read one of your recent Mocha musings in the Tidings. You sound like a person who takes a lot of notes.
Yeah, I guess I do.
But I bring this up just because I wonder if it's compulsive enough that you were physically taking note of the things that felt right as you were assisting Tony into his final days.
You know, what I did do was journal. And some of the best advice I got 2 years before Tony died, when we already knew we were walking into some different territory there, I got some very excellent advice from someone who said, you need to start a journal now. And I did. And I can tell you the journal of the last year of our lives together as a little family is one of the most precious things I have. Even though the last Christmas, we knew it would be our last Christmas, Pablo and I still talk about it as the best Christmas we ever had. And that's quite something to be able to say, because we knew he was dying. And yet it was so amazing and so rich and so full. So I took notes, I suppose, in the form of my journaling, but I didn't consciously take notes like for a book like this. This was really more upon reflection afterwards that I thought about things that I felt had been really valuable. And then I thought, you know, with no small amount of pain, of things that I wish I had thought of doing. Or, you know, maybe I wish somebody had told me, gee, that would be a good thing to do. But, you know, we're human and we can't do everything and we can't think of everything. And we do the best we can.
How candid should you be with each other? I mean, you, if there's the overall acknowledgement that, yes, this is we're getting down to the end here. I mean, I don't suppose anybody actually said this is probably our last Christmas. I only chuckle a little bit because my father said this is probably the last time we'll see each other. And then he apologized for saying that, but he was right.
That's really hard, too.
Yeah.
I remember with my grandmother, I was living in Europe and I'd flown back to the States and I gave her a hug and I knew because of the distance, because of the time frame of what my next visit would be, she and I both knew it would be the last time I would hold her. And boy, did I hang on tight. And I still remember that moment I had to disengage and turn around and walk out of that room. There are moments we know it's the last time.
Well, one of the things, and you touched on this briefly about making moments last, but I mean, in a literal sense, you talk about putting away your watch for a while. Just be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember one moment. We were so busy with all kinds of things, and he had a contract to finish for a publisher in Europe for his memoirs, his World War II resistance memoirs. And we managed to finish it, which was extraordinary. But I walked in one evening and, you know, he was in the hospital bed and I had this stack of to-do lists and notes and everything. And he just looked at me like I was insane, you know, and he said, we're at the 11th hour. Put those down. He was wiser than I was, clearly. But yeah, you're right. That's why I put that in there, because I think especially in our American culture, we get so caught up in doing. What do we need to do? What's on the list? You know, how much? And yes, that can also be vitally important. But there are moments where it's not important at all.
Well, and you do counsel as well to think about the person's whole life, mm-hmm. not just the part that's in front of you now. How difficult can that be when you're dealing with things like a hospital bed, medication, and frequent this and that and the other thing?
Well, it's hard. And I don't think you can be everything to that person. And you will, you know, run yourself ragged and drain yourself dry if you try to be. I mean, that's when family or close friends, we had visits from some very dear friends. One of our dearest friends, who is a retired rabbi, I was speaking with him by phone, and Tony really wanted to see him. And I remember him saying to me, well, I've got to be honest with you, Suzanne. I can either come up now or I can come up for the celebration of life or memorial. And I said, Benjamin, come up now. Of course, come up while Tony's alive, you know, forget the memorial. And he did. He flew up and we had a wonderful visit. So, and that was part of that reflection of the whole life. So, you know, and a lot of it depends on how comfortable the person is with the life they've led. I remember one of the hospice nurses saying to us, you know, early on, are there any trips you guys want to take? You know, because if you want to, do it now. We just looked at each other and we said, no, not really.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a whole lot in the 30 years we've been together, and we're good with that. And it was quite a wonderful thing to be able to say that.
Do you think you crammed a bit more into your 30 years together, knowing that it might be limited to something like 30 years?
With the age difference, it's very mm-hmm. possible. You're mm-hmm. right. I didn't consciously, but I think you're right. Possibly subconsciously. Yeah.
Okay. We've talked about the really tight-knit family, you, Tony, and Pablo, your son.
Mm-hmm.
How many other people, family members, other people were visiting in the final weeks or days of Tony's life?
Well, you know, not too many, just some very close, immediate family members and really just a very, very few close friends, because he didn't want a lot of that. He really did not want a stream of people coming in and out of the house. Of course, it was physically very difficult at that time, and he was in a lot of discomfort. And so, you know, I made sure the key visits happened for him. And then really for the rest, he just wanted to be with Pablo and I.
Yeah, this is a season of your lives together, you write in the
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
Not anybody's favorite part of life's rich tapestry, no doubt, but certainly a part of that tapestry. And, you know, I have to wonder how different your perspective is now, having lived through your spouse's death. I mean, in the sense that, you know, we never want to think about the end, but now you've seen the end.
It's hugely different. I have a lot of different feelings about death itself and about, I don't know, really, also about the spiritual aspect of things, because I totally feel him with me in everything I do. It that the love we had has carried over and is still very much there, and I can completely tap into that. So I don't feel that I've lost any of that. Yes, I've lost him here on this physical plane which we inhabit, but and it took me a long time to get over that sense of loss. But it's I think we all come to terms in our own way, but I am vastly different in some ways, absolutely, having gone through this, and more compassionate, maybe more aware.
But that's a really clear point of the book that comes through mm-hmm. many times over. Just you still feel the love of the person, even if the person's not physically here.
Right.
That's a big one. Suzanne Severide, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. Words by Suzanne, pictures by her son Pablo. She'll be at the Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7 for a reading and book signing. And we'll spend more time with her here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. We are talking about a subject Americans don't generally like to talk about very much, and that is death and dying, but more a focus on how we make the last hours, the last days, last weeks meaningful for ourselves and the people we are losing. Suzanne Severide lived through this experience. She lives in the Ashland area now. She lost her husband about 6.5 years ago, Tani von Rentergem. And she wrote a book called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. It takes her words and her son Pablo's photographs and combines them in a very quickly readable volume that just can be there at the bedside or at your elbow when you might need it. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. You can join our conversation right now. We'd like to hear from you about things that helped you in the final days of your loved one or perhaps afterward. 800-838-3760, the phone number, the email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Suzanne, there are a couple of pages in here about forgiveness. I mm-hmm. want to make sure we understand a balance here, because I don't think this is about raising old hurts at the bedside of your loved one in the final days.
No, I don't really see much use in that. Sometimes people think they want to get things off their chest, and I think that's more about them than the person who's dying, don't you? No, it's really more about forgiving yourself, in a sense, for the things maybe we didn't do right or hurtful things we said or did. And, you know, there are in any relationship, every relationship is fraught with moments of anger, moments of misunderstandings. That's just the way we are. If we were perfect, we'd be pretty darn boring to be around. But, yeah, that's really what it's about. And very often the person themselves has things they want to get off their chest. And I think just listening, letting people express themselves. And as I said, if you can't be there for them in that way, then get someone next to their bed who can. Sometimes even a stranger, a hospice volunteer, someone they can simply speak with, can be very useful.
Talk about the hospice support system. I mean, we've talked about hospital beds and I think mm-hmm. nurses a bit, but I mean, what other kinds of people were available for support for you and or Tony in the final hours?
Ours was more limited. As I said, we were living in a rural area up in northern Washington, and they don't have a lot of funding for things. So it was considerably more limited, I would say, than what you have available here in the Rogue Valley. And I think we're very blessed and lucky to have what we have here. You know, we have a lot of support systems here, I believe. And I would really encourage people who are in a situation like this to get in touch with their, you know, through their healthcare providers or their hospitals or their, religious affiliation, check with friends. But it's vital. Vital, because you can't really, well, I suppose you could, but it's a lot more difficult to try to do it yourself. And these are trained people. They really can be there for you in ways that you might not have thought of.
If there is a lot of family, and I know this is not the specific situation you dealt with, and I don't know if it's something that's come through in your work with the folks at Winterspring, but there can be a lot of family, and they can sometimes disagree. About what the person dying wants.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you have any advice on addressing that.
Well, I think that can be just enormously painful for everybody, and it can be painful after the death and ongoing. And that's, again, why I think it is imperative and vital and so tremendously useful to be realistic about the paperwork. I do know that the hospice organization up there, one of the first things they did was hand out a packet and say, get the paperwork done. And it forces the family to really start discussing and having those conversations that I know our local hospice organization here really encourages, having, quote unquote, the conversation. Like you said, Jeffrey, it's not a conversation most people want to have, but we are mortal. We are all going to die. And your chances of dying at home, dying without being hooked up, you know, in a hospital or some care facility surrounded by strangers, whatever, you know, your chances of avoiding the things that maybe you don't want are far better if you have communicated clearly and put it in writing.
You won't have control then, but you do have control now when you're of sound mind and body.
Exactly. And that's why people have worked long and hard to get these paperwork, you know, get this type of paperwork in place. And it protects the physicians and the nurses as well. It's very important for them to be able to respect the patient wishes, which I think the majority of medical people really clearly want to do, you know.
The medical stuff aside, though, I mean, and obviously as close as you had a relationship with Tony, you probably pretty well intuited the things that he wanted. But, I mean, how do you counsel people to have a sense? They need to be able to listen, I think, to be able to figure out, okay, they're tired. They need to rest. And I need to stop wanting to talk about old days with them right now.
Yeah, and I think it's really hard because the truth is you're watching the person you love dying. And that's a tremendously difficult thing. I think there is a certain amount of post-traumatic stress that comes with caregiving. I was exhausted by the time he died, absolutely drained. So you've got the emotional thing, you've got the physical thing that you're trying to do, just the sheer physical work, even if you're bringing in caregivers. Yeah, that's why I say in the book that if you can't be there for them in that way to listen to those things or whatever, make sure you get somebody else in there who can. Like, I know when Tony first began really talking about death, and he was very comfortable talking about death. He was never afraid of it. He was quite comfortable discussing it, but it was very hard for me to hear those conversations, especially in the beginning. But he wanted to talk about it, so I would bring in people. It might have been a hospice volunteer or someone from the clergy or whatever it was, or just a good friend, and then he could speak very openly without feeling that he was, you know, burdening me with these thoughts or whatever. Because yeah, it's frankly difficult as the spouse to have your partner talking about dying. You get more used to it depending upon how much time you have. But yeah, one needs to be very open to the realities of life, and death is one of them.
Some of the things, I don't want to call them exercises, but they are things to do with the person who is dying. Like, you suggest writing a letter to your loved one and then ask them if they want to write down or record something.
I did. And that was advice given to me while he was still alive. And I'm glad I actually asked him if he wanted to do that. And he said, nope, I'm going to talk to you now.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you what I want to say now. And that was fine, you know. But it's kind of nice to be able to just air those things, you know. And I purposely kept it as a small book because I wanted it very accessible. I think when you're in moments like that, you can't plow through a lot of text. I think the photographs, at least I've been told, make it accessible also. It adds the beauty of nature to it. And I just wanted it something that a hospice person could hand to somebody or a friend could hand to somebody. And you could just, you know, put it in your briefcase or put it in your purse and just pull it out at moments when you need just a little bit of comfort or reflection or a thought. And yeah, so I hope that that's been accomplished with this.
And talk about the process that you and your son Pablo went through in choosing his photographs for this work. Did he have a big hand in saying, I would like this one?
And yeah, we actually collaborated, and it was really a tremendous opportunity for he and I to collaborate on this, and I think very healing in many ways. And I went through and I made an initial selection of photos that I liked, And then he went through and changed out about 75% of them. And they were better choices. And they were, you know, and then as he's photographing some of them, we changed out for higher quality and things of that nature. But no, it was really a cool experience to be able to do with him. And one of my friends, when she saw it, she started to cry, and she said, you know, it's beautiful because I see that you've come full circle with the grief with this little book. And it feels really wonderful to have been able to complete it and let it have a life of its own now.
I just turned to the page contact. It shows you nuzzling a dog, but I assume this is for human beings as well. But it's a real important thing to have physical contact with your loved one.
Yes, and I think a lot of that can get lost when you're in these situations where there are strangers in your space. If you've got caregivers coming into your home, or if they're in a care facility situation or a hospital situation, it's very easy for somebody to feel extremely isolated. And I just remember there were times it was so important for him for me to do nothing but walk into the room, sit down, and hold his hand, you know? And you're right, touch is so very important. And we can forget that in the hecticness.
But it's interesting to think about it at this moment in the context of how important touch is through our lives. I mean, we talk about babies bonding with their parents. Skin-to-skin touch is really important. Everybody has discovered, hey, look at that. You know, Dad, take your shirt off and lie down with your newborn child.
Right.
And it's just as important on the back end, too.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And, you know, I mentioned in there, if someone's in a wheelchair, they can't come up and give you a hug. And we forget these things. Walk to them. You know, go to them. Remember that they can't get up out of that hospital bed. So just to try to be more aware.
You mentioned Tony was fine with talking about death, and we've noted already Americans are rather lousy about talking about death and dying. You have lived and worked in other places, so is this an American thing or a human thing?
Well, I think avoidance of death probably is pretty universal. We can't claim that exclusive right.
Well, death itself, sure.
But I think our American culture has some work to do. There are cultures where it is more considered part of the cycle of life. And I think that is a really healthy way to approach it. I think one thing with our American culture, and I certainly noticed this after Tony died, we are not comfortable with grief. You know, about 3 weeks after the memorial service, you're supposed to be just fine. You're supposed to be back to your chipper, cheerful self. And that's just not the way it works. And I do think we need to give a much wider berth for what are extremely natural feelings that come along with any major loss. And I'm not just talking about death. I mean, divorce is a major loss. Job change, all of those things.
Yeah, and there's not a get over it.
No.
That works.
It's not just simply buck up.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting, too, the amount of bereavement time we give for different family members. You know, for a spouse, you get, you know, 5 or 7 days. You know, for a parent, it's 2. Grandparent, 1, stuff like that.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these places I've worked. Vince and Eugene, you got the final call on this hour of the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, I just want to mention how important photographs are. I was a senior companion for a woman that was dying last summer and fall, and I went through her one and only incomplete photo album and helped her finish it off, and she really appreciated being able to leave that for the family. And then also, when my mother passed away, I put a photograph up of my mother in every room of my house, except the bathrooms, and would say, hello, Mom, I'm doing okay today, and just have a little bit of a conversation. I did that for a couple of years, and it really helped.
Wow.
Thanks for that, Vince. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you, Vince. That is so important, what he is saying there. It is so important. Yes, all I can say is absolutely true. Photographs are vitally important.
You write about photo albums in the book, don't you?
Yes, yes. And, you know, and I have always had photos up. And I think it's, you know, it's so important to remember the role this person has played in your life. A funny thing people can tend to do is sort of think, oh, I shouldn't bring up his name or I shouldn't talk about him. That's ridiculous. This person was a huge part of your life, whether it's a parent or a grandparent or spouse or child or whatever it is. You know, the person who has gone through the loss wants that person remembered, wants their life honored. So that's a great comment that Vince just called in with.
Back to the conversation about conversations about death generally. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you've made any note of the Death Cafe movement and have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I have. You know, I haven't attended one, but I think it's great. I think anything that furthers the opportunity for people to speak openly about this subject, which is quite taboo for a lot of people, is wonderful. And it's really supportive. And, you know, we have a lot of mixed feelings about these things. And it's great when you're with other people who, you know, you don't feel like you're going nuts or something just because you have certain feelings about things. No, that's great.
All right. So you've got this small book, When Someone You Love Is Dying, some thoughts to help you through. You've written a suspense novel, which mm-hmm. I understand, in both English and Dutch, is mm-hmm. that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there another long form project in the works?
I do have a couple of things that I'm hoping at least one of them will come out this year, but I'm going to keep it close to my chest until I'm closer to publication date.
All right. Well, we'll be looking for the publication and talk to him perhaps when that comes about.
Great.
Suzanne Severide will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7 with a reading and a book signing. Again, the book is called When Someone You Love Is Dying, Some Thoughts to Help You Through. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.